I'm amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Hello, welcome to the Playing Footsie Show. I'm Steve W. from the Playing Footsie Show, and I'm joined by Steve D. from the Playing Footsie Show. We're here to talk about things that have been going on in the news this week, mostly in financial markets, but also in the personal finance space. Mostly UK-focused this time, and we don't have Paul, but we're ready to give it everything we've got. Steve, how has your week been? Have you had a nice week?
It's been a decent week, Steve, to be honest. It's still pretty quiet at work, which I think we're seeing in the Forterra share price. But it's been okay. There's still stuff to get by on. It's just not, you know, not a full calendar of work like we usually have. In terms of my portfolio, Steve, I think I've had a pretty crappy week, to be honest. I started the week about £2,000 higher than how I finished it. And really, I can't point my finger at anyone in particular who that was. It was a general portfolio decline, which comes with the territory when we've got interest rates rising beyond what we maybe expected or what the market expected, and some tough talk in Fed. Well, and what we've had in the UK as well, Steve, which we'll get onto a little bit later. But how about you? How was your week?
My week has been quite nice. This week and probably one more week are quite nice weeks for me. So we're at the point now where the amount of time for leave my wife has been taking is about to run out, but it's also the end of term. So we've got a sort of fortnight or so, maybe a little bit longer than that, window of neither of us being at work and both of us being at home with the baby. It will be kind of, at the moment she's kind of technically back at work, but the way it works with maternity leave is all the time you're off, you build your accrue holiday and you have to kind of take that pretty much before you start back again. So we're back in the nice position where she's technically in work but burning through a load of built-up leave days. And actually, over the last year, that includes quite a few bank holidays for stuff like the Queen's funeral and the coronation and so on and so forth. There's been quite a few bank holidays, more than you might have in a kind of normal year. So at the moment, this week has been we're in a situation where the weeks are quite all right. It's going to switch over in a little bit to she's back at work and in work, and I'm doing childcare, which is going to be, I think, enjoyable for nobody, based on what I can tell. But it's what we're going to do to try and make things work and fit together, and I will find ways to fit my own work projects around looking after Alistair, whose birthday it was 2 days ago, because it's now Sunday, so he is one. The year has flown by, but it feels like some of them, it feels like it really hasn't. There's a saying that the years are short, but the days are long, and I think that kind of resonates quite well for us. There's been, especially the nights have been really long with him. He's not an amazing sleeper. But yeah, good week or so. Portfolio-wise, similar to you. Down and down sort of fairly broadly. I haven't been looking that closely, to be honest. It's not been a week for watching portfolios, but nearly everything looks sort of attractive in buying territory at the moment, at least compared to where it was a week ago. And I've got a couple of decent-sized dividends coming up in the next month or so. Decent-sized by the standards of my portfolio, which is not decent-sized in the scale of anything that anyone else ought to be interested in. But by my standards, yeah, dividends coming in and chances to use that money.
Yeah, same as you, Steve. I've been, every dividend I've had so far has just been banged into, well, and a deposit has been banged into a money market fund at the moment. So I've just been sat there biding my time, waiting for better prices. The thing is that the stocks that I want to, that I'm happy buying quickly, you know, without much thought, your Amazons, your Googles, etc., they have ran up a lot recently. They've ran up from where you would say they were massively undervalued to probably about right. So they take a little bit more thought for me. So where it was a case of me just getting the cash and jamming it in, it's not such a case for me now. So I've sat, put my money into this money market fund, which is I don't know why people would take trading 212's interest rate over it. It's probably going to deliver about twice the return of trading 212's 1.65%. So yeah, I've just been sat in that. I've already made a couple of quid, Steve. I mean, who could complain about a couple of quid? It's much better than the 3p a day I was getting from trading 212. And I did take £200 out of it, Steve. I sold £200 down and I bought Rightmove when it fell to 495, although it took a little while to execute and execute at 496. So I don't like that average, so I'm going to have to try and fiddle with that a little bit. But yeah, Rightmove at 490 looks great again to us, Steve. I mean, we say this every time it falls under around, well, between 480 and 5. We're always very excited about it. Is it one that's on your radar again?
Yeah, it is. It's not quite there. I'm looking sort of 480 rather than 490, but it's I've got a close eye on it, along with a lot of other stuff too. I take your point about the stuff to do with money market funds and trading 212. You never go broke taking a couple of quid, so you're onto a winner there by the sound of it. I suppose the way I think about Rightmove at the moment is I'm sort of interested in why it appears to be kind of getting caught between two ideas. One is that UK mortgages are a mess and that's bad for the property market. More on that story in a minute. And the other is every tech company is supposed to go up because AI in it. And Rightmove is, I mean, it is a tech company. I was going to say it's the closest thing the UK has to a tech company, apart from maybe RELX or whatever, but it's a tech company by pretty much anyone's definition of what it actually does. So it seems to be kind of going on the downwards route, probably if it doesn't talk about AI enough, I suppose.
Yeah, to be fair, I don't think I've ever heard them talk about AI, but I wonder what AI at Rightmove would be exactly.
I'm not really sure what anything at Rightmove would be. It's just a platform that needs to kind of sit there and charge people to use it and kind of attract more users. I mean, could you do better targeted advertising with AI? So if we think, what is AI to Meta? It's better advertising, basically. What is AI to Rightmove? Maybe it's better advertising. I think of Rightmove as a platform business, sort of like Meta's social media arms, but maybe that.
Yeah, I suppose when you use the filters on Rightmove, you are giving them quite a little bit of information in there, aren't you? So maybe they could start to target advertisements based on the things you're putting there. The idea of that being though is that sometimes I like to go and like stick in numbers that I can't possibly afford and go and have a look around some rich people's houses. So maybe not the best way of using it.
Yeah, I also use it kind of incorrectly. I mean, since I've been looking at the property market not terribly long ago, and I have a sort of general interest in it to do with stuff like this show, we will occasionally be driving through some part of the countryside and I'll think, huh, houses here look nice, wonder what they cost. And it would be wrong to infer from that that I am seriously in any way in the market for buying one of those things. I mean, even if they came out as, oh, this is an absolute steal, I can't work out why this is so cheap, I'm not about to move there. Even if I think, yeah, lovely part of the world, house looks really young, really nice, I should probably do this. It's much better value than Oxford nearly everywhere is. But Rightmove shouldn't infer from that I'm about to go and move there.
Well, I have my builder network for house pricing. So when I'm around in areas and I see you're on site and you think, oh, this is a really nice house. You always say to the builder, it's like, oh, how much are these selling for? And they're always too willing to give you the information, thinking that you might be interested. And it's like, oh, this one here is going to be about 800,000. You think, oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah. And you walk off site and think, who's paying 800,000 to live in Grimsby?
I'm not paying 800,000 to live in Grimsby. I don't know that there's that. It's mainly a port, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And you know the rumours of it being a fish town and it smells of fish are completely true.
Wow. Okay. Weather's nice down in this part of the country. You're a bit closer to the pole and a bit further than the equator from me. But
27.
27 is, yeah, about the same actually as we are here. Feels like there's a storm coming. But before it does, let's get to some actual content about markets and rates and stuff. Interest rates went up in the UK this week after some fairly steady inflation data. So UK interest rates have gone up to 5%, which is the highest they've been since April 08. Interest rates in the Playing FTSE show are roughly steady, but we're more interested in the kind of financial stuff, I suppose. Steve, what's been going on?
Inflation data came out and pretty much straight off the back of it, the Bank of England and Andrew Bailey were out on the microphones saying that inflation wasn't coming down at the rate that they expected. It was a bit of a shocker that it stayed essentially the same year on year, and that they were going to raise rates again to to try and counter it, which, I mean, it hasn't worked so far, so let's try and jam the button again and see if it works this time. The good news, Steve, and we're going to do it in good and bad, so we're going to give you the little bit of a shit sandwich here, but the good is that savings rates have gone up again. So if you're in a position where you have quite a decent amount of savings and a fixed mortgage, this will be a net benefit to you at the moment, Steve, on the proviso that they come down eventually. But I've got the updated savings rates for you, and I'm not going to go through them all like last time. I'm just going to go through the instant access ones, which are, you know, looking really, really attractive at the moment, I think. But so the headline rates were that, I mean, Monzo tried its best. It's gone up to 3.7. Chase has gone up to 3.8. But quite a few banks now have breached the 4% rate for instant access savings, which is very, very good. So Zopair was another one that I like, just finished in 3.9 something. But again, we're not talking about that. Chip came in at 4 dead, Steve. Crew Bank, which is a new bank. And if you use Top Cashback at the moment, you'll get £15 if you use Top Cashback to open an account as a welcome bonus. They're doing 4.1. From the 1st of July. If you don't want the £15 and you fancy a £10 Amazon voucher, you can open it through Money Saving Expert. I don't see why you would want that. £15 is more than 10, but there's your option. Oxbury, Steve, I assume that's somewhere near you. 4.11%, but they want £1,000 for you. No joint deposits, and they'll only take up to £500,000, Steve, so it won't be any good to you. Okay. Synergy Bank, 4.12%. That one has a 0.91% bonus for the first 12 months. They want £1, up to £1 million, Steve, so more suitable for you. Principality Building Society, 4.15%. They want £1 to £1 million as a minimum max. It's online only, but you can only withdraw from that one twice a year. And then topping it all off, Steve, was GB Bank, which you have to open it via Raisin. It sounds a bit Brexity to me, but it's 4.15%. The minimum you can deposit or withdraw at any one time is £500. It has to be a serious savings account. The min is 1,000, the max is 85,000, and you can apply for it online via Raisin, which is essentially an online savings marketplace. So 4.15, Steve. I can remember when rates were 0.15 and we were excited about it, or not excited about it. What do you think about these?
I was never excited at 0.15, but you were talking about GB Bank at the end there, and you said you have to open it via Raisin, and just based on the discussion we were having beforehand about it sounding a bit Brexity, I thought that was going to be you have to open it via racism somehow. but that's interesting, actually. So I have been seeing interest rates going up on my savings accounts, which are, as so many numbers are, between the £1 and £1 million mark, the amount of money I would be looking to put into these things. I've mostly so far shuffled them between three different providers that I already have accounts with. Those are Marcus, Chase, and Monzo. And until about this time, Monzo hasn't really been much of a contender in any of those. If I'm honest, they've kind of lagged the others. Chase got ahead for quite a while, then Marcus took things back over, and now there's not that much to choose between them. But, and this is a feature that's been coming out with, or that people have been drawing attention to, who are thinking about banks and their general stability, I am very prepared to go yield hunting for 0.5 of 1%, or less than that, in fact, 0.05 of 1% in any given month as rates go up, because it is really, really easy for me to move money around like that. I'm not saying I'm about to cause a bank run. But if the idea was that consumer deposits are sticky because it's a nuisance to change them and switching costs are high, which has traditionally been an argument with a bank, that might be true if you have a lot more money than I do, but it isn't true at my level. It is absolutely worth it to me to get another 20 quid at the end of a month to go and press the button three times. That's probably the easiest money I'll ever make, another 20 quid for just pressing transfer, done, and then the next month do the same thing again.
Yeah, agree. If you've got some longer term savings, Stephen, you've got a decent amount. There's some really, really good 1 year fixes at the moment. If you can afford to, you know, be away from your money for a year, most of them, Steve, are coming out of 5.76 at the moment. That's Alica Bank, Smart Save, and Oxbury again, which I assume must be near you somewhere.
Maybe.
Oxbury, they only want £1,000. The other two want £10,000. But 5.76 is a, that's a cracking rate, really.
5.76 is quite a serious rate, so it's essentially a bond in that it has a repayment date or where you get your money back, and it has an amount written on it that is the amount that you receive. It's unlike a bond, then, just thinking out loud slightly, in the sense that you can't buy it below par value. So the amount you get back will be exactly the amount you get on your maturity date. But I think that's... I have a bit of money in some UK government bonds that had a roughly 1 year expiry that come out in September, I think. The reason that's in there is because that money is eventually going to be used to pay a tax bill. And it had to just sit. So I could either pay it early, in which case I'd give away all the interest. But with interest rates then at 3% and a bit, I thought, well, let's put it somewhere. And settled on UK governments as the result. I bought them below par. I think I'm getting close to 5 on those, which is not bad, and it was worth doing at the time, because who wouldn't take another 20 or 30 quid, right? Just if it's a straight choice between pay it now and don't take the extra cash, or wait and do take it, yeah, I reckon it's probably worth it. The amount isn't going to change. I have to pay tax-wise as long as I'm done before my January deadline. But that's these rates are creeping higher, aren't they, Steve? You tempted by anything for a year?
I jumped the gun a little bit here, I feel. I took a 3 year fix. Well, we're about a year. No, it can't be a year. It must be about 6 or 7 months into it. And I took a 3 year fix with Nationwide when their bond came out for 4.75%, which is not bad considering I've already had 6 months of it. That was our basically the money we were going to overpay our mortgage with. Makes no sense to overpay when the rates are so good. So we put all of that money into this 3 year fixed. I think it was a bond from Nationwide, but a bond only in the sense of savings bond. But yeah, that's what I've taken at the moment. I mean, I'm always sort of like hesitant to lock up any kind of money really when the rates are only a percentage higher, but. I mean, some of these are now, I suppose some of these are nearly getting on for 2%, aren't they? But I always think the minute you lock something away, you always kind of think, ah, bollocks, I wish I had that money for something. Do you know what I mean? I don't know whether it's some kind of weird mentality that just I've got or something, but I am always hesitant to take fixes in places. I took a fix on Tandem as well, actually, thinking about it. I took, my emergency fund's grown way, way bigger than it needed to be, so I skimmed some off my emergency fund and stuck it for a year in Tandem. I think that was 4.25%, which that seems to have been a pretty bad move at the moment, but... I guess we'll see on that. I wouldn't be going for any of the 5 year fixes, Steve. I think even though you'll get a 5 to 5.5% return on a 5 year fix, which, you know, not too great in the first couple of years, but probably the next three could be potentially really, really good savings rates. But I just think that's a long time to lock your money up when the economy's so uncertain.
Yeah, it's interesting, that one. My own sense here is that my emergency fund isn't in as healthy a position as yours. It's fine, but it leaves me a bit more vulnerable than I would like in the event of an emergency. So we've just come through the last month of... the May payday, basically, was a tough one in our household. That was time that my wife was taking off work and out of the end of statutory MAT pay, and was basically therefore getting paid nothing at all. And that was the 1 month where we had to deal without her salary, which is the bigger of our two salaries. So we had money saved to deal with it. We also had some stuff overshoot a little bit, so our emergency fund took a bit of a knock there. So I'm looking to put it back. But getting more money on an emergency fund is... very, very welcome. I did notice that NatWest, where I automatically siphon as much of my emergency fund as I can, which isn't very much every month, that digital saver thingy that they have that pays 6%, they sent out their new rate card for that. That rate is going absolutely nowhere for the moment. They're not seeing anyone else offering a more attractive deal at the moment, so they don't see the need to push that any higher, which I guess is probably sort of fair enough.
Yeah, fair enough. First Direct is better, though. I think First Direct are doing 7, so it is a shame that they didn't bring them in line. But these are not really what they're paying, remember, because they're restricting the deposits in.
Right.
The end rate is 6%, I guess, once you've got your 1,500 in the next year. Mm. But the first year, you get your 1,500, 1,800 quid, and it's only about 3 or 4% because of the way the deposits are restricted. So it's not a massive outlay for them. This is just a loss leader, really, to get customers in the door.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, if you can get hold of deposits and just go flat on them for the moment, and they do, it's working from their perspective. They have a good amount of my current account. I spend out my current account because it double rounds up into that 6% thing. So I'm going around buying coffees I never would have bought, thinking £1.70 goes into the 6% thing. I will retire early someday. Never. I think that's probably it for the good news, Steve. Should we get to the less good side of this?
Yeah, okay. So the less good side of it is that obviously everybody's mortgages are going up. So I did a little bit of digging for you, Steve, because I'd always sort of wondered why America was offering longer fixes than in the UK. And I'd never fully understood why we hadn't sort of adopted these sort of 25, 20, 30, 35 year mortgages all fixed like they do over in the States. And the reason for that, Steve, is because about 50% of our mortgages are dished out by building societies. And building societies have to have about 50% of their lending has to come from deposits, essentially. So they're not using like a fractional reserve like banks are. So to stop them having an asset liability mismatch, they have shorter fixed terms, going back to a variable rate, and that allows them to, that allows them to continue without the fear of obviously having to pay a higher savings rate than they would be receiving in the mortgage. So that's one of the reasons why, why we have this sort of ticking time bomb mortgage crisis that we have. So if you've got a spare few minutes this afternoon, I'd encourage you to go and firebomb your local building society. I am, of course, joking, Mr. Policeman. But anyway, mortgages. Government put out a note yesterday which just tries to explain their thinking on mortgages. The Chancellor has met with the FCA and with the Bank of England to try and put some kind of procedure in place to try and help people out with their mortgages. I'm using inverted commas for people on Spotify who aren't watching. But there are a few facts and figures came out of it as well, Steve. So they said that mortgages in arrears and defaults are actually still quite low. They said that 0.86% of all residential mortgages are in arrears. That's in this first quarter of 2023. If you're looking back in 2009, the first quarter in that was actually 3.32%. So it's a time bomb, but it's not exploded yet, Steve. The proportion of disposable income spent on mortgage payments is about 5.4% compared to 10% in the 1990s and prior in the financial crisis. I don't really know if I believe that, Steve, because I think house prices have gone up to such a degree and wages have not kept up. I think 6% on a mortgage or 7% on a mortgage is going to feel the equivalent of 10 or 12 or 13% that we experienced in the 90s, because the difference in price between house prices and affordability is actually stretched, and things like government stimulus and help to buy have hindered that rather than helped it. But anyway, they reckon the average homeowner that has remortgaged in the last 12 years has about a 50% loan to value ratio. This indicates that they think homeowners have considerable equity in their homes, which makes it easier to manage repayments. Lenders have less than 10% owner-occupied mortgages on their books, with loan-to-value rates of greater than 75% compared to about 25% before the 2008 financial crisis, and they think that this puts the market in a significantly stronger position than before. Anyway, they have still gone out and they have agreed these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 things, so anybody worried about their mortgage repayments can call their lender for information and support without any impact on their credit score, and we would encourage you to contact your bank, who are there to help if you are worried about repaying your mortgage. Customers will not be forced to have their homes repossessed within 12 months from their first missed payment. Customers approaching the end of a fixed rate deal will be offered the chance to lock up a deal for the 6 months ahead. I think it's only 3 months currently, so they're doubling that, the six. They will also be able to apply for a better deal right up until their new term starts, if there is one available. A new agreement between lenders, the FCA and the government, permitting customers to switch to interest-only mortgages for 6 months or extend their mortgage term to reduce their monthly payments and then switch back to their original term within 6 months if they choose to. Both options can be taken without a new affordability check or without affecting their credit score. There'll be support for customers who are up to date with payments to switch to a new mortgage deal at the end of their existing fixed rate deal without another affordability check. These seem like stupid ideas, but let's keep going. Providing well-timed information to help customers plan ahead should their current rate be about to end. This is a problem, I think. They don't want people to drop onto the SVR. They want people to try and find themselves decent deals. And lastly, offer tailored support for anyone struggling and deploy highly trained staff to help customers. This could mean extending their term to reduce their payments, offering a switch to interest-only payments, but also a range of options like temporary payment deferral, part interest payment repayment, and the right option will depend on customer circumstances. And Jeremy Hunt, got to be careful rifle. That's a strange name. Sometimes you say the wrong word. There are two groups of people that we are particularly worried about. The first are people who are at real risk of losing their homes because they fall behind in their mortgage payments. And the second are people who are having to change their mortgage because their fixed rate has come to an end and they're worried about the impact of their family finances of higher mortgage rates. And basically, he then said about 15 paragraphs, which said he went to the FCA and said, what is the minimum we can do? And they said this. How do you feel, Steve?
I feel like there were two parts to this, Steve. So I read the note that you sent me, which was this one yesterday, and it felt to me like there was a kind of glass half full part and a glass half empty part. So that kind of, I guess, climate survey that you might consider the first part about the number of people on who are currently in mortgage arrears versus heading for mortgage arrears. I was also confused by the disposable thing. I'll come back to that in a second. But that was clearly supposed to be positive news, right? The thought that it's not immediately, okay, it might be the kind of worst things have been since 08-09, and let's be honest, things are pretty bad in 08-09 as a kind of baseline. It reminds me a bit of people comparing the pandemic to the war, which notably many people did not survive. So saying it's kind of better than the war or better than 08-09 doesn't tell me a terrific amount, but nonetheless, okay, we shouldn't kind of blow the thing out of proportion. I take the point. And then there was the kind of glass half empty bit, which is here come all our support measures. I was also confused, by the way, by the... I don't understand what the definition of disposable income is. And I don't mean that in a kind of pedantic definitional sense. Here's a very basic thought for you. When I think about our household's disposable income, I tend to think of it after we've made whatever the equivalent of a mortgage payment is, basically. So in no sense do we spend our rent money, mortgage money, and that's kind of our disposable income. There's things that we need, which are that and gas and electric, and that's a variable cost depending on what we use, and there's food, and that's a variable cost depending on what we kind of consume. But I always think of disposable income as what you have after that, not before it, basically. So the idea that it's only taking up 5% of your disposable income might take up 5% of your kind of gross income, but even that seems quite low to me. It's the single biggest expense that most of us have, I think, and who are all these people with that much money kicking around?
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I'm just trying to figure out what mine is in my head then. So I think mine's more between 10 and 12% my mortgage of my disposable income. So, and bills is about 35, 40% of my disposable income. So it's definitely a lot higher than they suggest. I'd be interested to hear what everybody in the everybody listening, if you could just drop yours in the comment section. How much disposable income is your mortgage, and what percentage of it does it take, and what percentage of your bills does it take up? I think I'd be like 15 and 30 or 15 and 35 or something like that, Steve.
Yeah, or rent or whatever it is you pay on a kind of house outgoing thing. Then we get to the kind of second side where I'm torn on this. I have two different thoughts here. One is that I like this kind of, and another is that I don't like this at all, because I don't. The reason I don't like this at all is because I don't think it's going to work. The reason I do like it is because I think there is at least some nuance going on here. So, by and large, I've heard three sort of broad views, fairly radical, extreme views on what ought to be done in this situation. One is nothing. The government ought to do nothing at all. It's people's problems. People took out loans. It's politically unwise for the government to help what is, to be honest, a kind of middling area of society. If people who own their homes outright see everybody else getting mortgage handouts, directly mortgages get tough, they will think, where was that when I was doing it? Plus, there's a bunch of people underneath that who are kind of looking to buy, unable to get mortgages, and thinking, why can't I get a mortgage? Someone else pays a damn thing for me if I can't afford it, specifically the government. Okay, so there's a do-nothing line. Then I saw John McDonnell in The Guardian saying banks must just eat the cost out of their profits, basically. If banks can't pass through higher rates, they shouldn't be allowed to. It will cause hits to their bottom line because they should do better when rates are higher. But they're not allowed to. We should stop them doing this. We should make banks wear it as a result of bailing them out in 08-09. That's also quite radical. And the third one is the government must pay everything, which arguably only kicks the can further down the road. This is none of these, but I don't see how it's going to work. At best, it sticks a six-month sticking plaster on things and does away with a load of affordability checks. Now, remind me, Steve, why do we have affordability checks again?
But that's the thing, isn't it? It's that, I guess I see both sides of the argument here in that... Well, not John McDonnell's argument. I think John McDonnell just wants to... If John McDonnell should just nationalise, that should be his policy. Nationalise all the banks. What's the point in having having a free market if we're just going to intervene at every occasion? It's got to be one or the other, hasn't it? But yeah, I don't know, Steve. I'm just thinking the government basically blew this balloon up themselves. So they know it's politically unpalatable for house prices to fall. So all they've done is continuously inflate the market by giving government stimulus indirectly and directly to the market. And yeah, and we are where we are. And the problem is now the bubble has grown too big and they've encouraged people to buy houses that they perhaps couldn't afford. And they've relaxed affordability checks to the point where people are taking on mortgages that take massive amounts of their disposable income up. And then when people turn around and say, oh, actually, this, you know, I could afford this at 0%, but I can't afford this at 6%. And then the government throw their hands up and say, well, you're stupid, you shouldn't have took it out. And I think that's kind of tricky to me. I do think that house prices need to come down. I don't have a problem with house prices coming down. I have a problem with my own house price coming down. That's my daft fault for buying it at that kind of price. But and I don't intend on moving, so I don't care. But yeah, I find that hard for people, especially these people who are taking out 95% mortgages or even the new 100% mortgages. If you get a 20% whack on your mortgage, you're talking about 120% mortgage next time you come round. Sorry, on your house price, you'll get 120% whack on your mortgage next time you come round. That's a different story there, Steve. That's a point where, you know, perhaps a company isn't prepared to, you know, isn't prepared to lend you anything, I guess. And that's a different kind of story. We don't want people forcibly moving out the home, but also we need a better system of educating people that just because when you stick your numbers into your approval in principle and get, you know, 500,000, that doesn't mean you should go out and buy a £500,000 house. It means you should then continue to do the maths and figure out what you can actually afford rather than what they will lend you.
Yeah, a couple of further ideas. So switching to an interest-only mortgage for 6 months, or that idea to me looks too short term to be any use. I'm not saying they couldn't push that out again for another 6 months and effectively let people hang on interest only mortgages until such point as rates get back to a level where they think, okay, I'll go back to a repayment model. But I don't see this going away in 6 months, by the way. I think if you switch to an interest only mortgage in 6 months, you'll have the same question in 6 months' time of, okay, now what do I do now that rates are at, well, the average two-year fix at the moment is 6%. I think that could be 7% in 6 months' time. That we're looking at Christmas, basically, from when we're recording this. That'll be nice for everybody. Although my predictions this year have been terrible, so chances are this is probably a genius idea. But I don't see it. I don't really see how 6 months helps here. The idea of being able to lock in an offer for 6 months and then wait and see if a better one shows up looks useful to me, but I'm not sure that's new. I'm pretty sure my sister-in-law said she was already on such a thing, having, this is going back to sort of like April, March or something, where her mortgage advisor had said, look, go get this thing, see where things are in 6 months, you can keep this or you can change to a better one if you find a better one in that time. And I remember thinking, you ain't going to in 6 months from February. And if only I'd made that prediction more public, so I'd been right about that one. But that doesn't look particularly new to me, Steve. Have you heard of this before?
To be honest with you, I didn't realise it was a thing. It might be one of those things that you can do and nobody told you about. I thought once the deal was agreed, it was locked in. I know you can you could take out a deal early. I don't think that's anything new. I know you can take out a fix to start, because I've done that before myself. Started a fix to start once my old fix closed, because I left a day in between it so I could make an overpayment free of charges. But yeah, I didn't know that, Steve. I didn't know it could be done. If it could be done, it seems strange that we're broadcasting it as a new thing, but again, that's not beyond this current Tory government.
No. The thing on everybody's mind at the moment who has a mortgage seems to be roughly the following. It's a good question, right? So imagine then that your mortgage is coming up for renewal. Neither of ours is, but suppose a lot of people's are. You have a choice then. You can either not fix it, you can go on to standard variable rate, which we generally think is not a good idea, or you can fix it for 2 years at 6%, let's suppose. Suppose you can get about the average for now. Or you can fix it for 5 years at 5.18%. And there's a lot of people wondering, what do I do, what do I do, what do I do? And here, I guess, are my thoughts, and they're quite bleak. If I were in this situation, here's what I would be thinking. Okay, so here's what I'm kind of banking on. Do I think it'll be better to be renewing in 2 years or five, basically? Assume for the moment I strictly can do either of these, because and it won't knock too big of a hole in my kind of household budget. So I'm trying to work out, are rates going to be lower in 2 years' time when I come off my 6% thing, or are they going to be lower in 5 years' time when I come off my 5% thing? Because if rates in 2.5 years are going to go through the floor again and go back to zero, I don't want to be stuck on a five-year thing at 5%. I guess what I would think is the following. From my perspective, rates are quite hard to predict at the moment, exactly where they'll be in 2 years' time. I think it was a lot easier to predict where rates will be in 2 years' time 2 years ago, when they were at all-time lows. But people were, if I were the kind of person who was taking out a mortgage back then and not anticipating rates to go up, I think rate predicting is notoriously difficult, which means that I would try and get off this game, and I would probably have to take a five at this point, because I would think, if I can't predict these things, the only thing I can do is take something that I know I can definitely afford, and I would have to take a five at 5 and a bit percent. And if I thought that was a bad idea, it would be because I thought I had some confidence in my ability to predict rates, which I probably shouldn't have based on the fact that I'm currently trying to renew now.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. For what I'm doing, I'm basically saving up the biggest pile of cash I can possibly get my hands on, and I'll be looking into an offset mortgage if rates are still high when my mortgage comes out. I've still got 3 years left on my mortgage, so a lot can happen between now and then. It's looking like a masterstroke, Steve, taking out a 1.28% mortgage nearly 2 years ago. I think I've got 3 years and a month left, so yeah, I'm dead chuffed with my market timing there. I think I've done a wonderful job. But I'm thinking offset mortgage, if I can get, you know, 20, 30, 40 grand or something like that saved up, get an offset mortgage and bang that in the offset account, that will help to smooth out some of the issues that I'm going to have with a rising interest rate. The alternative being, if there's a decent fix by then, of course, that you can just choose to whack that off the balance, or if you can afford the fix, just roll with it. I don't really want to be extending the term, Steve, because I think that's got hidden costs to it that people don't tend to think about. But if it's a difference between you keeping in your house and not keeping in it, then I would do everything possible to keep in it.
Yeah, I like the idea of trying to plan for an offset, mostly as a kind of insurance policy. And it's an insurance policy that you get paid okay on at the moment, right? Because, as we just mentioned, you can keep money in cash and still pick up, well, maybe 5% if you can do it right. But at least you can get a better something than you could have sort of 5 years ago. I think the danger at the moment, or what really worries me, I think, most of all, is people getting into a position where they are effectively forcing themselves to try and predict interest rates, and I don't think they can, because it's hard, not because they're really bad at it or anything, but your approach, right? Interest rates go higher, okay, you offset to take some of the sting out of that. Interest rates in, what did you say, 3 and a bit years when you kind of come down, I suppose they're lower in 3 years, could be, I don't know. Worst thing that happens then, you have a load of cash sitting around and you fix again and you're fine on your mortgage. That to me looks like kind of setting yourself up to go okay either way round, right? And you can live with higher rates rather than trying to take a guess at it and say, okay, in 2 years they're going to be this much lower, this much higher. They're now back at April 08 levels, and pretty much nothing bad happened in mortgages in 2008 as far as I can remember. So I'm sort of wary about this. And you pointed out that inflation's not coming down at the rate the Bank of England was sort of hoping for. Last time, it's not coming down at any damn rate at all. We're stuck at 8.5%. The US has crossed over, so they are now getting real returns on, well, cash, but bonds and so on. Their interest rates are higher than their inflation rates. They're stopping, pausing, okay, hawkish pausing. Maybe not quite convinced they're out of the woods yet, but gosh, they are having a better time of it than we are at trying to bring down inflation, Steve.
Yeah, they're definitely having a better time of it than us, Steve. They've done a much better job than ours, which kind of makes the Bank of England look even more incompetent than perhaps you think they are. The fact that it's coming down so quickly over there and here, we're still almost double what they are, is kind of tragic in a way, isn't it? It's the fall from grace of England is almost, England in the UK, sorry, is almost complete.
Yep, I think there's more to it than that even. I think I'm worried about, I blame politics as much as I blame Bank of England here. I mean, Bank of England only has one available course, right? Rates go up, or alternatively you reverse it and rates go down. That's basically it, right? And they have been pressing that damn button. They were slightly slow getting started, but I don't think the difference entirely reduces to mishandling there. I think we've mishandled in a number of other ways. That's for another day. Enough complaining about things. Steve?
I was just going to say, even though our bad politics and our bad economy, Steve, it hasn't stopped American companies looking into our Brits, has it?
No, I was going to say the same thing. The good news is we can now be colonised by America from the outside.
On the cheap.
Yeah, and it's absolutely ruined an article I was writing for next week. So it's June 24th now, which means we're getting to the end of the month and with it the midpoint of the year. I was doing some scribbling on the best and worst performing FTSE 100 stocks of the last of this 6 months, as it will be for the next time, and bottom of my list for the FTSE 100 was Ocado. Unfortunately, Ocado has now jumped 30-odd percent in a day, meaning that I now have to look into Vodafone again, I think. But Steve, Ocado, what's going on?
Interesting, Steve, really. The rumours around the rumour mill, nothing confirmed yet from either source, is that Amazon has taken a look at Ocado and is preparing an 800 pence offer for them, which is a lot more than they're trading for at the moment, Steve. I think they were in the 380s at the time that this deal was announced, so Amazon looking to pay double for Ocado. I don't know. I think most shareholders would have took an extra 20p per share. But here we go. Big offer. It is completely... caught people left field. It makes a lot of sense. Amazon Fresh, here's a way to get quick access to a large portion of the UK market. The fleet is already there. You get the robotics arm. A lot of things in there that Amazon could probably benefit and use. Yeah, it looks like a good offer to me, Steve. I was just looking, just out of interest, Morningstar actually against the deal because they've got a fair value estimate of Ocado of £15.50. Now, I'm not sure if the analyst forgot to look at the last earnings where Ocado managed to lose about £500 million in February. But yeah, I think it's a really interesting deal, Steve. And Amazon shares rose as well on the deal. So shareholders potentially think that this is good as well as Ocado do.
So yeah, so you're buying yourself, of course, here, right? With both Amazon and Ocado in your portfolio?
Yeah, and I think Amazon will fit quite nicely in the capital incinerator pie.
Yeah, I mean, Amazon might just colonise your entire capital incinerator pie the way it's going. But yeah, I tell you, so Ocado, as you pointed out, a trading report in February, losing money still, further from profit than, well, as far from profit as it ever seems to have been. Pretty nice tech, pretty nice kit. It had a big boom, of course, during the pandemic when everyone was kind of online shopping, but the general trends are going away from Ocado at the moment. There's a return to shopping in person, less good if you basically provide online infrastructure. M&S, who they're kind of mainly partnered with, people are shopping away from the kind of more expensive end of shops. And at the moment, they have a kind of cyclical headwind, which is exaggerating the fact that they didn't really get to the kind of profitability during the pandemic that maybe some of their optimism was hoping for. Nonetheless, if you are Amazon, I think 800p a share is the sort of price it makes a lot more sense to buy if you're Amazon than if you're me. So I had this written off as a no, I'm not buying this, I don't know when profitability is coming kind of thing. I definitely don't know it with Amazon either, but I can see that Amazon has a potential use and a capacity for what by all accounts is pretty good tech as it goes in the kind of robotic space. We saw your video on this when we talked about the stock, I think, Steve, but at the moment, it's kind of good tech and not a lot of cash production. And good tech and not a lot of cash production is the kind of theme that has been losing lately. So I guess it makes a lot of sense to see why Amazon might be jumping in here, right?
I think so. There's just two things that I'm... Well, I mean, so $7 billion is about the offer price for Ocado, and that's so for change to Amazon, isn't it? That's, you know, potentially... few days operating cash flow most probably for them when they're not building 100 warehouses, but yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. The only issue that I've got with it, and it was rightfully pointed out in a couple of articles, is that Ocado's got a pretty big deal, its robotics arm, its delivery arm, with Kroger. And should, that's Kroger in the States, obviously, and should Amazon take over Ocado, I do wonder how that deal continues with Kroger, because obviously Kroger's not going to be wanting to be seen to be buying from essentially a big competitor like Amazon. Even if the technology's good, I wonder how that deal, if that continues or if it sours. I mean, for Kroger's sake, I would hope it continues, and obviously for Ocado's sake, I hope it continues. But I would imagine that we would see Kroger start to look somewhere else, which, does that make the deal look a little bit less attractive? I'm not sure. If Amazon keep the deal, and obviously keep Ocado for Amazon Fresh, I think it looks quite attractive to me, Steve. I think, I would be voting this one through as a shareholder.
If I were a shareholder, I would be voting this one through. I'm not, and now the shares are in kind of an interesting no man's land. I hadn't seen the 800p thing before, but it looks to me like Ocado's now 537.6 closed at the end of the week. And if you didn't like it at 343, it's hard to see from an investment and kind of cash generating perspective how you like it at 537. I mean, you might have thought there was a lot of room for buying at 343 or so, but at 537 that leaves you about another 50% potentially to 800 if this goes through. If it doesn't go through, feels very Activision Blizzardy this to me. If it doesn't go through, it's probably going back down again. But I wonder about the sharing thing, Steve. I mean, okay, so you could have kind of tech owned by effectively Amazon that Kroger also uses. There's something similar going on with sort of Tesla, Ford, GM, and now the real big dog has waded in. Rivian has said it would like to connect itself to Tesla's charging system and build things that are kind of Tesla compliant. Does this feel different to you from a kind of cooperative standpoint?
Yeah, this is different, isn't it? I get, to a degree anyway. So I'm not in favour of Tesla sharing their charging points. I've seen a lot of arguments trying to convince me otherwise, and I don't believe any of them. The issue I have with Tesla sharing charging points is that's one of their moats. They're super fast charging network, and that's what it is, Steve. I've used it. It's a super fast charging network. You're talking 25 minutes. You roll in there with 60 miles left on your tank, Steve. In 20, 25 minutes, you'll be nearly full, or at least three quarters of the way full. And that is pretty incredible for electric charging. And the thing is with the Tesla, so if you tell it you're going there, it even preps the battery so it's even faster. It makes a horrible racket while it's doing it, but you feel like your car's going to explode, but it is just, I assume, warming the battery or preparing the battery for this charge. But look, that's Tesla's moat. When you use your sat nav and you know you're not going to get somewhere, your car will automatically route you via this supercharging network, so you can continuously charge your car and keep going. I think that's a moat. I think sharing that with other companies diminishes the moat. Now, look, if you were going to tell me that this is a 99.5% gross margin product for Tesla, then I'd be like, share it with the world. Share it with the world. This is going to make you so rich. But this is the lowest gross margin product, of the positive gross margin products that Tesla offer, that aren't by Elon Musk's brother, that don't make any money whatsoever. This is a pretty low gross margin product. I would not be keen to diminish this moat for Ford and Rivian. If Ford and Rivian came and knocked on my door and said, we'd like to use your charging network, I'd be like, build your own. Build your own. I ain't got this to share with you. And the problem is that now there's a lot of Fords on the road, Stephen. There's going to be a lot of Ford EVs on the road. Say what you like about Teslas and what have you. They won't sell the most EVs. It will be a Ford. It will probably not be a Rivian. It might be a GM. Whoever it is, they're going to put a lot of load on this network, and they're going to be looking at people like Tesla and saying, look, we signed this deal. You come on, build some more. When it's a low-margin product, this is crappy revenue for Tesla. It's going to be one of those things where they say, hey, look, we did $85 trillion in revenue, but how much profit did you make? $6 million. It's just not good revenue. It's busy full work, and I just wouldn't want to be involved in it, Steve.
Airtel Africa's cable laying stuff, huh? I hadn't worked out whether I thought positively or negatively about this. I feel like it does change things quite a lot. I mean, probably because I never really had a strong Tesla thesis for how this is supposed to work out. I mean, on the one hand, I can see the attraction to effectively owning a load of infrastructure, because it's only infrastructure. People need it. You charge them money for it. the downside to this is it's capex heavy infrastructure. It will cost a lot to build, it will cost to maintain, presumably, and I'm not aware that, well, it will depend on what they can find margins wise from what they can get off everybody else and what it costs them to redo this. I don't know what that equation looks like, in all honesty, but here is what I am fairly sure of. The money that they're now not spending on building out infrastructure, charging points and so on, is money that Ford and GM can use to spend building cars better and cheaper and shinier and that kind of thing. So it feels to me like Tesla's made its own life harder work in terms of dominating in car sales. And maybe they're better off for not doing that. Maybe they're better off for trying to take a slice of everybody else's car sales revenue via charging. I doubt it. The big loser to me looks like, I think it's called ChargePoint, who basically run charge points. And if Tesla becomes a kind of North American standard for that, this is incredibly bad news for a kind of charging point operator. But I feel like this is Tesla. You put this in terms of their moat. I'm not quite sure I get their moat terribly. But it feels like it's them taking a step backwards in their car sales battle in order to try and win kind of elsewhere. And I don't know how I would model that from a kind of revenue perspective.
I mean, it could be a response to slowing car sales, Steve. They could be looking for a way to prop up sales. What Tesla will not want to do for a few quarters on end, while, you know, credit is tight, like this is report 1% or 2% revenue growth, or flat revenue growth, or even declining revenue growth, because that will... that will set alarm bells going. You don't have a 47 times multiple if your growth is not 20-25% year on year, even at the numbers that Tesla's churning out at the moment. So it could be a response to this, Steve. It could be a response to get a little bit of busy foolery in, some low gross margin product to try and tick that sales revenue growing. I think we'll just have to wait and see on this one. But I think I'm definitely seeing a lot of Teslas on the road, Steve, at the moment. They are a very popular car where I live, which is incredible for a new entrant to do as well of this. And as if Rivian does as well as this, I think I'll be shocked. But yeah, interesting, especially at the price of them, Steve. You just think they're such an expensive car. It is amazing to see so many of them about, but yeah, I agree with you, Steve. ChargePoint is the big loser here, but I think Tesla's a pretty close second, sharing this one out.
Ouch. Okay, we weren't talking about Tesla, by the way. We were talking about Amazon and its ability to kind of seize all the infrastructure for more or less everything. They have a large kind of delivery network as well, which is kind of interesting. Bigger than FedEx, you were saying, Steve, before we went on air to me.
Yeah, interesting, really, in that so Amazon Logistics, which is kind of I guess it's kind of snuck into being as big as it is, I would say. I mean, I knew that Amazon obviously had a logistics arm back from 2010, somewhere around that, but the rate in which it's grown is frankly incredible. So I sent Steve a chart, and if I remember, I will stick it on the video so everybody else can see it here. But it basically shows the total share of US parcel volumes from 2014 to 22 in percent, and it shows USPS, United States Postal Service, UPS, don't know what that stands for, FedEx, and Amazon Logistics. And basically, United States Postal Services starts at about 38%, that's dropped to 32%. UPS has gone from market leading 40% to second place 24%. FedEx has stayed fairly static, Steve. It's about 21%. It drops a bit, but then gains it back, and it's now at about 19%. But Amazon Logistics, Steve, has just come out of nowhere. It's gone from zero all the way up into third place, 1% before UPS at 23%. So with USPS and UPS declining in their share count, as in their share of the market, sorry, and Amazon Logistics rapidly increasing, that's kind of exciting for Amazon shareholders, isn't it? I think we're about to have the second largest in terms of parcel volume in the US, but I don't think it's a million miles away, Steve, from being the top.
I mean, it's just terrifying, isn't it? Thinking back here in the UK, when you want to buy something nowadays, mostly you pretty much just buy it on Amazon, especially if you need it in a hurry, because their ability to ship stuff and the amount they've no doubt spent building that out, by the way. So there's clearly a moat there in the sense of it would cost an awful lot for anyone else to try and get level with them in terms of having the infrastructure, fulfillment centers, driver network, so on and so forth, to try and compete with this. It's not at all surprising to me to see them taking market share because gosh, they are good at fulfilling stuff. And could they then turn that into to shipping other things? Yeah, maybe. The UK's answer to USPS, which is now called International Stuff Delivery or whatever it's called, it used to be called Royal Mail. They are, I think, deliberately getting worse and worse and worse, Steve. I mean, I feel like we're seeing a big impact from Amazon over this side of the pond as much as anything. When did you last see a UPS van?
Don't know. We used to have UPS coming to work a bit, and I always used to remember the guy in his like dog poo coloured uniform.
Yeah.
Which always used to make me laugh how they would make them wear that. But yeah, I don't see much UPS in the UK. I think Hermes is probably the most popular here, maybe DPD. They're the two I see the most of. I really dislike Yodel. The guy who delivered my Yodel HelloFresh got a complaint on Tuesday when he delivered my HelloFresh, Steve. He decided to chest pass it into my door in front of a camera, so I kindly sent it to his boss. So we'll see if I see that guy again. But yeah, I don't know, Steve. I think it's exciting to see something as an Amazon shareholder to just see what happens when they want to put their foot to the floor and grow an area. And that's basically what we've seen here. Since the pandemic, they've gone from about a 6% market share to today, well, as of last year, about a 23% market share. So that is incredible growth, which kind of shows you why Amazon built all those extra warehouses, because I don't think they were anticipating growth to be this fast. And it really has raced off.
We always think with Amazon, or I always think with Amazon, and probably you as well, but maybe some people disagree, that the main thing I would not want to be is one of Amazon's competitors, because they seem hell-bent on just driving everybody else out of the marketplace, and they have this ability to do it that comes from their kind of size and structure. Would you be worried if you were like a FedEx or somebody?
Yeah, I would be. Yeah, I saw FedEx's results at the weekends, even they were not very good. I'll just quickly give you them just before, because we've got to cover fractional shares really today, haven't we? I think at some point. But revenue for FedEx was down 10%, daily package volume was down 6%, operating income was down 21%, Steve. EPS was down 28%. They're not the kind of things that you would be particularly excited about. Op margin, Steve, year on year, down 108 basis points. I don't want to be a FedEx shareholder, Steve, especially when they're spewing out guidance saying that they'll probably do 1650 to 1850 and the market wanted 1831. They're basically saying we're going to miss. Yeah, looks like demand weakness. FedEx Express not doing very well. Their only decent margin business is FedEx Freight, which has about a 20% operating margin. Steve, that was down 18% year on year. Not much to love there, I don't think.
No, I was looking at them and thinking a little while ago now, short-term voting machine for the moment. The market didn't like them very much. I thought they were trading at around 15 times earnings. They're now trading at around 20 times earnings, which to me looks like way, way, way too much for something like FedEx. You are right, though. We have a story about fractional shares to talk about, so no fractional shares of FedEx in your ISA for you, Steve, not just because you don't want to buy them, but my dream of buying a Berkshire Hathaway A share in my ISA also appears to be going up in smoke.
Yeah, completely disappeared, Steve, unfortunately. And I thought it was also kind of fun to just buy 0.001% of Berkshire A and make trading 2-on-2 by the rest of it, But alas, we may soon not be able to do that. So there is a bit of a backstory to it, Steve. The Telegraph broke the story on the 19th, which was Tuesday, was it, Steve? Or was that Wednesday? I don't know. But they basically said that they have a source at HMRC that said that fractional shares are not available, shouldn't be available to be in ISAs because they believe that the rule set in 1998 by the government was to say that it only recognises full shares for tax purposes. Now, there's a lot of kicking of free trade in this article. They've come out and basically Telegraph has pointed the finger at free trade in particular, but obviously as trading 212 users who also have fractional shares in things like the pies, we're also going to be, we're also going to fall foul of this rule. Free trade, they reckon, could be ordered to pay thousands of pounds in capital gains tax, or free trade users could pay thousands of pounds in capital gains tax. The rule, Steve, is quite interesting because, and a lot of people have been getting caught up in the terminology of it. So I thought it might be just quickly interesting to just look at it from a broker level and explain what happens when you buy a fractional share. So say, for instance, you want 0.05% of a share of Tesla. So you will put that order through. Trading 212 will go to the market and they will buy one whole share of Tesla. They will split that up. And here's the interesting part, Steve. What they don't do is they don't put that fraction of a share in your account. They give you a derivative. So they give you a derivative that says, this is not a share. This is 0.05% of a share of Tesla. We hold the whole share, but this user is entitled to the benefits of 0.05% of a share, which is all well and good, Steve, but derivatives are not allowed in an ISA. So when Free Trade come out in their statement and say, fractional shares are just shares, well, they are. That's true. But what is in your ISA is a derivative. And under HMRC ISA guidelines, derivatives are not allowed in ISAs. So it is a little bit of letter versus spirit of the law. I think this is move fast and break things, as people like to say. And this is what Free Trade and Trading 212 have done. They've moved fast and broke things. This might just be a case of an old law, a sensible head in terms of government. If we've got any of them left, would take a look at this and say, stop being pedantic, a fractional share is a share, and derivatives in this regard should be allowed. But there will also be people who, especially in receipt of lower tax receipts, would take a look at this and say, derivatives aren't allowed in ISAs, charge them, and fine them usually as well for a couple of years of lying to you. How do you feel about it, Steve?
Pretty much like derivatives in this context are functionally equivalent to shares, behave like shares, are backed by shares. If you wanted to make a law that says as a broker you can only facilitate fractional shares in ISAs if you hold the underlying security to match against it, I would be absolutely fine with that, because the concern is you don't want a load of derivatives without underlying things to back them up. Absolutely make that a law, from my perspective. There goes a lot of people's dividend reinvestment things then into their ISAs, because I was trying to work out whether I owned anything that was a fractional share in my ISA, and I thought the answer was no, and the answer is yes. I own Realty Income to some number of decimal places, because when I get a dividend, I reinvest it back in, and that is nearly never, and it would never be an exact, I buy a share as a result, partly because the dividend's not high enough, but even if it was, the share price moves. And every time you reinvest it, the dividend you get next time is higher. And unless the share price and the dividend were to move exactly in sync every time, along with the exchange rate, because that's a US stock, in sync with one another going forward, I would always end up on a fraction. Is anything the matter with that? No. Could you impose a kind of capital requirement on 212 to make sure that they weren't liable for a bunch of stuff that was that they couldn't cover? Yeah, absolutely. And a bit like kind of short selling and so on. But would you, should you be doing that kind of thing? I don't see that there ought to be a kind of structural problem here, Steve. I don't see that there's a danger that can't be regulated away without axing the possibility of fractional shares and or derivatives in ISAs.
Yeah, look, I don't think there's a problem here at all. I think this is a non-story, and I would hope that it gets resolved rather quickly with somebody saying, stop wasting my time, fractional shares are shares. But I did ask Trading 212, Steve, and I did get an official response if you want to hear it. Mm. It's very short and sharp. It just says, the ISA regulations do not prevent holding fractional shares in an ISA. The term share is not defined within the regulation itself. And while HMRC's view is that a share must mean a whole share, Trading 212 and other market participants believe a share can mean a fraction of a whole share. We have been discussing this issue with Her Majesty's Treasury and will continue to do so until such a time that there is a resolution. In the meantime, we will continue to monitor the situation and update clients if needed. Thank you for your understanding. And that's it, Steve. I think that covers it pretty comfortably. I would assume that this has caused panic for some people and they've probably been selling off their fractions. I still hold a fraction of a lot of things in my... Mind you, that's in my GIA, but I do own a fraction of AdGen in my main account. And I'm not in a rush to close that fraction off at the moment, Steve. I am just willing to sit on my pants and see what happens. Are you doing anything different?
I'm not doing anything different. I'm a little bit more... uncertain about what I think of this. So on next week's show, when we'll be in our halfway point of the year, we might have a look back, or at least I intend to have a look back over some of my predictions, see how they're shaping up, because this feels like a very natural point to have a look at that. One of my predictions, I think, is on a coin flip as to whether it will come off or not. That's Coinbase, which I said would not be publicly traded by the end of this year. There's a chance it might have like tripled. There is also an equally good chance, weirdly, that it might have gone out of existence as a public company. But their CEO is busy having these kind of discussions with the SEC, the regulator over there. And he and they have very different ideas about what they're supposed to be doing in the context of these things. I mean, Coinbase, long story short, is getting sued. And he keeps saying that the point of this is to try and get some clarification for the crypto industry. No, it's not. It's to stop them breaking the law. And I wonder whether this is something, whether HMRC might view this as the same thing. And Trading 212, okay, you have one idea of what a share is, as does maybe Free Trade and a bunch of other brokers and so on as well. I'm not picking on Trading 212 or particularly making a case for them. But it does give me sort of pause for when... the company that I am involved with in the sense of being a customer and only a customer and not a particularly loyal one at that has a different idea of how things work to HMRC. That gives me just cause for to keep an eye on this situation, I think.
I posted a hilarious meme, Steve, which I will remember to put in the video at the end of this, but it was just about Coinbase and crypto, and it's the muscly Doge. Crypto 2017, we will destroy USD and usher in a libertarian fantasy land. And then it's obviously the timid Doge. Crypto 2023, regulators, please work with us.
More on that story next week when I come back and describe how spectacularly wrong I am about everything this year. Steve is having a better time of it than I am. Can't remember what Paul predicted, but he won't be here to let us know. We have it on authority that he will not be back next week. He will hopefully be back the one after, but who knows what will happen then. We're not that good at predicting things 2 weeks into the future. That's all for our show for this week, though. Thank you all very much for listening and watching, and bye for now.